We will now hear argument in number 011120, Meyer against Holly. Mr. Benedon.
Justice Stevens, and may it please the court. The question presented should be answered with the following bright line rule. Imposition of vicarious liability under the FHA should be determined by application of established rules of corporate and agency law, not criteria unique to the FHA. Under these principles, corporate shareholders and officers are not vicariously liable for the torts of the other agents of the corporation. The Ninth Circuit held that a different rule should apply under the FHA, that vicarious liability could be based on control alone. That is not, nor should it be, the law. While the starting point for the analysis is necessarily the statute itself, while Congress has authority to expand the class of persons liable for violation of a federal law, when it has done so expressly. The FHA, which neither defines nor expands the class of persons liable under the Act, and as this Court stated in Best Foods, this silence is dispositive. Specifically, Congress has spoken directly when it has wished to impose a control test. For example,
suppose that I were to agree with you and the Court were to agree with you as to your criticism of the Ninth Circuit's reasoning and that it agreed with you, too, that general principles of agency and corporate liability apply. Based on this record, could we go on to say that under California law and real estate law generally, the real estate salesman is the agent of the broker, and therefore the broker is liable under agency law? Would we have to remand before we did that? Because this is discussed in the respondent's brief, and the respondent makes it quite clear. And maybe you disagree, but the law is cited on page 15 of the red brief that under California law, the broker is the principal. I take it the principal would be liable under respondeat superior in this case.
Correct, Your
Honor. If we find who the principal is, we know the principal is going to be liable.
That's where
the California law, the broker is the principal.
Your Honor, my answer to that is severalfold. First, the distinction needs to be made between a corporate broker and an individual broker. Mr. Meyer, in this case, is a corporate officer who holds a broker's license solely as the officer of the corporation. The corporation is the employer of the agent. The agent operates under the license held by the corporation.
Well, isn't it fair to say, maybe you'll take issue with this, that the corporation operates as a broker only because it has the individual broker's license assigned to it?
It has to, Your Honor. A corporation as a paper person needs human beings to fulfill the function that the corporation must do, as does any corporation. There will always be supervising officers.
Is there any California law saying that the corporation is the principal in a situation like this? And not the holder of the not the named broker?
The named broker, again, to answer your question, no, not that I'm aware of.
This is a bit.
Let me ask the opposite. Is there any California case in which the named broker in the corporation has been held liable as the principal solely because he's the named broker?
Not the designated officer, Your Honor. The corporation has been held liable.
Yes, that's what I'm talking
about. But not the designated officer broker.
Is there a difference in the licenses, the individual license that Justice Kennedy was referring to, and that's mentioned on page 15 of the red brief, the individual broker license, and the statement that the individual broker licensee is vicariously liable, and the broker who holds the license under the corporate name Are those different certificates?
Absolutely, Your Honor. There are separate licenses issued by the Department of Real Estate in California, one to individuals who act as brokers and one to individuals who are brokers only in their capacity as officers of a corporation. Those are separate licenses. The only license in this case was held by Mr. Meyer as an officer of the corporation. He could not step outside the corporation and act as a broker. His existence as a broker depended on the corporation. He could not transact.
May I ask you this question? You explained to Justice Scalia that there is no California case holding a corporate broker liable in this situation, as I understand. Are there any California cases going the other way? Has the issue ever been presented to the California courts?
Yes, it has, Your Honor. In two cases, there have been one state case and one district court case cited in our briefs, in the Graubel case. They've held that the California statutory scheme imposes only a disciplinary remedy for any violations of the scheme, such that a broker, a designated officer broker who violates any of the provisions of the statute, may be subject to discipline, but is not basis of a civil action.
So in this case, the individual could be subject to discipline, but not to liability, is it?
Correct.
What were your other reasons? You said you had a multifaceted answer or something like that. What are the other prongs or the other facets of your answer?
The other facets is that liability under the FHA cannot be premised on California agency law. There have been the agency under the FHA is determined on federal rules of agency. To determine federal agency, as this court held in General Contractors, you look to the restatement, which has a two-prong test. One is the right of control, but the other is that the person controlled has to be acting on behalf of the principal. Here, the agent is working on behalf of the corporation. In this case, when Mr. Crank went out and did real estate transactions, he was acting on behalf of Triad. He was not acting on behalf of Meyer. The problem with looking at each state structure is we're going to end up with a patchwork construction of a federal statute. The law may be different in Nevada than from Oregon, than from Washington, than from West Virginia.
Suppose it were the majority rule that a real estate broker is the principal for the salesman. Would we follow that rule generally?
Again, Your Honor,
And again, I'm referring to the red brief at pages 14 and 15, mm-hmm. which sets this out. You say there's a distinction because there's a corporate broker and an individual broker.
Correct.
And we can explore that a little bit. But suppose it were the general rule in most of the states that had addressed the subject that the broker is the principal.
To answer that question, I think you still need to make a distinction between individual brokers and corporate licensed brokers. We do not dispute that.
Well, I was simply addressing the point of whether or not state law as opposed to federal law controls. And if it's the general law in most states that the broker is the principal, then that would certainly be sufficient for the imposition of liability under this federal scheme, would it not?
Again, I disagree, Your Honor. I would say that the rule still, you need to still look at the federal law of agency rather than how the state defines the relationship between the broker and the agent. You look to the federal rules of agency to determine agency under the FHA.
I thought you said those were general common law principles that I presumably the states would share.
The general law principles applied in the broker-agent context would establish that the agent, the sales agent, is the agent of the principal broker when the broker is acting in his individual capacity, when the agent is acting on behalf of the principal of the individual broker and subject to that broker's control. The situation is different when it's a officer broker who is not the agent in that situation is not acting on behalf of the officer, he's acting on behalf of the corporation.
Then, in, if I understand your argument correctly, you're saying that the discussion whether it's California law or federal common law is, in this case at least, academic, because under California law, if you were to apply it, there is no relief for these plaintiffs, that the only remedy, where is it, the license is held in the corporate name, is a disciplinary sanction?
To date, that is how California has treated violations of the California statutory scheme. Correct, Your Honor.
Only by these corporate brokers or by individual brokers?
Excuse me, Your Honor. Individual brokers as well.
Okay.
It's a statutory scheme that applies to brokers in general and salespersons in general who allegedly violate the act.
But I thought you said that if this were a license to an individual broker, if this were held, the license were held by Meyer as an individual, that he would then have a principal-agent relationship with Crank. Is that not so?
That is correct, Your Honor, if it's an individual broker's license. I think I may have caused some confusion. Under general principles of agency law, common law principles of agency law, the sales agent is in an agent-principal relationship with an individual broker. If there is a violation of the act by the broker under California law, then he would be subject to disciplinary action. That is separate and apart from vicarious liability under the FHA, which would adhere based on the principal-agent relationship.
Is there an issue in this case about piercing the corporate veil as a means of holding Meyer liable?
Not in this case, Your Honor. We hold that the theory and doctrine of corporate veil piercing is available in the appropriate case, as it would be under any case under the general common law, although here it wasn't raised and it's been waived and it's never been proven.
But was there some reference to veil piercing in the respondent's brief in the Ninth Circuit?
On the last page of argument in a footnote, Your Honor, there's a reference arguing that based on sole ownership that they could establish an alter ego. Mm-hmm. But as a matter of law, that's insufficient to establish alter ego.
Refresh my recollection. Did this come up on a motion for summary judgment?
First a motion to dismiss, Your Honor, followed by a motion.
Which was denied, then there was a motion for summary judgment.
The motion for dismiss was granted in part, Your Honor, as to all the state law claims,
okay,
the 1981 claim, and it proceeded just on the FHA claim.
Now, so if it came up on a motion for summary judgment, then whatever evidence the plaintiffs were going to rely on for the veil piercing would have had to been brought forward. Isn't that right?
Absolutely.
And what did they bring forward?
Nothing, except sole ownership, which we...
Sole ownership is the only thing...
Which is in dispute. Which is in dispute. We maintain that ownership was in fact transferred, but we are assuming for the purpose of this proceeding that there is in fact ownership resided in Mr. Meyer.
I thought that if... that a judgment winner, as the Hollies are at this stage, can defend the judgment on another ground. In other words, the Ninth Circuit ruled in their favor, and now they're saying, well, here's another theory on which we could prevail. I didn't know, certainly they can't get an immediate victory. But if they attempt to defend the judgment on that basis, aren't they then entitled to go back and make the case rather than taking from them their victory and saying, you lose? They say, but we have another theory that would be viable. Up till now, we've won with this one. Why isn't that altogether appropriate? They should now be given a chance to air that other theory in support of the judgment.
The theory was never raised below. An alter ego isn't of itself a fact-driven inquiry, where it's a And so the fact that it wasn't raised below, it's now been waived. It can't be raised for the first time in this court.
Even if it had been raised, my understanding is in order to have it sent back on the basis that although the court below relied on one theory, it could have relied on the other, the motion for summary judgment put the plaintiff to his proof to at least come up with facts. The assertion of facts, not the demonstration of them, but the assertion of facts that would support the other theory. And the only fact contained here is control. So if control does not suffice to pierce veils, that's the end of the case, it seems to me.
That's correct. That is correct, and that is our position.
I thought there were a bunch of things. I mean, the government, in its brief, lists a whole bunch of things. He was the sole shareholder. He was the president. He did control it. He paid the taxes in his own Social Security number. He made various transactions that violated the terms under which it was supposed to be the corporate form. And he didn't train the person properly. I mean, they have a list of things, which I take it they didn't just make up, that they're there in the record. And then they say that, in the Ninth Circuit brief, what it says in the footnote is that evidence will show that Meyer is the sole shareholder of Triad, and thus an argument to pierce the corporate veil would be meritorious. Well, they don't list all those things in that footnote. That's true. But we should send it back and let the Ninth Circuit decide. I guess that's basically their argument, and I think I want to hear as complete a response to that as you have. Maybe I've heard it already.
No, I would like to amplify on that, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. The issue of alter ego that's been now raised for the first time in this court by the Solicitor General is based on speculation beyond the showing that there was sole ownership and that there is no insurance coverage. Everything else is unsupported by the record in terms of establishing that there was a failure to adhere to corporate formalities, that there was undercapitalization. All of that is speculation, and the argument boils down.
Was it not even asserted? I mean, to survive the motion for summary judgment, you don't have to prove it, but you have to say, I will prove it.
No, it wasn't.
It wasn't even asserted.
It was not even asserted. It's asserted for the first time in this court.
Well, in the footnote, they mention it in the footnote.
They mention sole ownership in the footnote.
Well, that's you're quite right.
Yeah. And, for example, your Honor made reference to payment of taxes. While that was alleged, it was never proven at the summary judgment stage. That's just an allegation there.
I don't know what that means. While it was alleged, it was never proven at the summary judgment stage.
Right. There's
there was no evidence brought in at all to establish it.
That taxes were paid under his ID? None whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, was there an affidavit on their side claiming that?
On the other side claiming that?
Yeah. How did it get raised?
It was raised solely as an allegation in the complaint. And then when they came time for them to put their proof on the table, it wasn't there.
So at the summary judgment stage, they didn't rely on that, is what you're saying?
Correct.
They did, okay.
And did you deny it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But again, it was not raised as a disputed material fact on the summary judgment, so there's no formal denial in the record because it was never raised. I'm denying it now.
You said there was no genuine issue, no tribal issue at the summary judgment stage, that there were no facts?
That there was no issue regarding payment of taxes under Mr. Meyer's personal ID number.
But if the question is the liability of Mr. Meyer, and at the summary judgment stage, it's not a trial, you don't prove your case at that point. It's only if there's no genuine triable issue.
Right. The only issue on the summary judgment was whether or not Mr. Meyer was still the owner of Triad Corporation. The district court found not. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals found that there was a disputed issue on sole ownership.
But what was the relevance of whether he was the owner or not? I don't quite understand.
They're claiming that that was sufficient to establish alter ego, Your Honor.
Alter ego, but not piercing the corporate veil.
Well, I'm using those interchangeably. I apologize.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand you.
I used those interchangeably. They both, alter ego as a basis for piercing the corporate veil. They were arguing, and in fact the Ninth Circuit held, that sole ownership of the corporation was enough to pierce the corporate veil.
They were arguing that, so they were arguing the pierce the corporate veil theory then?
No, they solely based on sole ownership, correct.
But the purpose of investigating the sole ownership issue was to determine whether or not they could pierce the corporate veil. Is that right? Which seems to me as though the issue of whether they could pierce the corporate veil was at least raised, and the question is whether their claim of sole ownership was sufficient to establish that point. Maybe I'm misunderstanding something.
Right. Well, that's the argument that's made in their footnote on the last page of their brief, is that sole ownership would establish an alter ego sufficient to pierce the corporate veil. And as a matter of law, that is insufficient.
But now I'm just a little puzzled about the extent to which it was raised in the district court. Was there a debate in the district court as to whether your client was the sole owner or not?
Yes, there was.
And what was the purpose of that debate in the district court? Wasn't it for this very same reason?
They were trying to, no, I disagree. I think what they were trying to establish in the district court was the control exerted by my client over the corporation, as opposed to saying that he should be necessarily a veil-piercing
I don't remember the facts correctly, but I thought that control was really not in dispute. I thought the person to whom he transferred stock didn't get all the stock, did he, or did he get just some of the stock?
He got some of the stock, but ownership.
So he still would have had control.
He would have had partial control as a shareholder.
I see.
But the Ninth Circuit held that that was enough.
Not that it was enough for piercing the veil, but that it was enough for what?
It was enough to impose personal liability.
On what basis? Not on veil piercing?
No, solely on sole ownership. They say the Ninth Circuit taking its lead for, I believe, the Seventh Circuit said basically that in a situation like this where you have sole ownership under the FHA, that's enough to impose.
Okay. You don't have to pierce the veil.
Correct. It's an almost per se piercing based on sole ownership.
Just returning once again to the broker problem, I'm looking at Gibson versus Davis Realty, which is a case written by Judge Molinari. It's cited on page 15 of the respondent's brief. That was a standard respondeat superior case where the salesman is in an automobile accident and they seek to hold the principal for the damages caused by the accident within the course of his employment. Mm-hmm. And this is the case where the statement is made that the broker is liable for the misconduct or malfeasance of the agent in the course of his employment. And it's a case much like this where there's a corporation that holds the license. There doesn't seem to be a distinction between the corporate license and the broker license that you made. Was the law changed since the Gibson case? Or?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. Again, I don't have the facts of that case at the tip of my fingers.
Well, it's relied on in the respondent's brief.
But again, in that case, I don't recall if it was a corporate broker or whether it was an individual broker. But if it was a corporate broker and they're holding them individually liable for the torts of the...
Well, as I understand the facts of the case, it was an individual who held the license and he operated through a corporation. Right.
Well, again, I would say that what California decides to do is not what what determines under the federal statute. It's been argued by both sides, and the case law is consistent that it's federal rules of agency. And under federal rules of agency, the salesperson is the agent of the corporation, not the individual broker. there are no further questions, I would just like to conclude and save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Schwimm.
Justice Stevens, and may it please the court, I'd like to begin by addressing the veil piercing and the preserving issue, particularly with respect to Justice Scalia's question, because I disagree with my learned friend on the procedural posture of this case. There was a 12b6 motion to dismiss. In the complaint at that time, there were essentially two theories. The complaint said that Mr. Meyer should be liable as an individual because he owned the corporation, and the complaint also said that Mr. Meyer should be liable because he was the officer broker. The district court granted in part, even with respect to the Fair Housing Act claim, the 12b6 motion, and in particular held that the allegations of the complaint with respect to ownership under no circumstances could lead to liability. And the only thing that the district court did not grant 12b6 on was the issue with respect to liability based on officer broker. That led to discovery. The district court then granted summary judgment because it was the district court's theory on that issue that there could not be liability unless Mr. Meyer held an individual broker's license, as opposed to what he holds in this case, which is a license through Triad. Or more properly, according to the California law, Triad holds a license through him. So with all respect, what the district court held in the 12b6 motion was that no set of facts that the plaintiffs could prove could justify veil piercing. We never got.
Well, could prove or claimed they could prove in response to the motion. I mean, you don't have to sit back and say, I wonder what they might be able to prove. You have to have made an offer of proof. And what the court held was that none of the facts that you claimed you could prove would suffice. Isn't that an accurate description of what the holding of the court was?
And the facts that we alleged were that Mr. Meyer was the sole owner of the corporation, which they denied, and that that was sufficient to impose individual liability. And when the district court granted 12b6 motion, my understanding of that is that he is saying, under no set of facts will you ever win. Now, what would order?
That you have to have something more than simply a person being a sole owner of a corporation, otherwise a person couldn't create a corporation with himself as 100% owner.
Absolutely.
All right, so what they're saying is you didn't allege anything than that, and you certainly didn't support anything other than that with affidavits or other.
That was my point. Yeah. With respect to the summary judgment.
Well, if you didn't, then you're out of luck, aren't you?
I don't think so, because at the 12b6 motion stage, we are told that you can't even proceed.
No, I'm not saying 12b6. I mean on summary judgment.
Yeah. If my learned friend was right that this was a summary judgment dismissal of that claim, I might agree. But that's not right. We were stopped at the very pleading stage. We were prepared to show both of the key factors with respect to veil piercing, which is that the corporation is heavily underfunded. In fact, in a colloquy with the district court, the defendant's counsel, after the 12b6 motion, Your Honor, when the only thing left was the summary judgment with respect to the broker situation, the district court said, is there any money in the company? And the defendant's lawyer said, no, there is not.
Okay, I have your complaint here on page 16 and 17 of the joint appendix, first claim Fair Housing Act. I don't see anything there about veil piercing or anything like that. Where is it in the complaint?
Correct, Your Honor. The phrase veil piercing is not mentioned.
No, or anything even vaguely like that. I mean, what it seems to say is that Mr. Meyer himself did all these things or through his agent.
Okay. The allegation, if I could refer, Your Honor, to page 4 of the joint appendix in paragraph 6 of the complaint, says that he owned the corporation, and on that basis he's individually liable. And then it goes on and says he also was the officer broker of the corporation, which is the other theory.
Yes, I see what it says he owned the corporation. What I don't see is something that says, and therefore he is liable, because he owned it. I mean, it just seems to be the part where you're describing the parties.
There is another part, Your Honor. Page 7 of the Joint Appendix, paragraph 13, which carries over to page 8, essentially the same thing. I'm not suggesting that there is additional material there, but there is the allegation of ownership leading to personal liability.
No, I mean, to be honest with you, I'm just debating with myself whether we should send this back to the Ninth Circuit, tell them work this out or not. And district court judges are not mind readers. They can't make up what you're saying in a complaint unless you say it and unless you argue it. So that's why I'm pressing you on this. I'm trying to find the particular point where you really made this point to the district court so the judge would focus on it and make a decision.
Well, I wish it was more detailed, Your Honor, but it seems to me it's sufficient for notice pleading. The district court understood it. The defendants understood it.
Well, he didn't seem to, in his opinion, understand it, because the only reference he has to veil piercing seems in a footnote in a paragraph, and what he seems to be saying there is referring to a different argument, the argument that there could be no veil piercing because he didn't even own this corporation. And he says that's really wrong. It's not true. Or maybe he said it was right, but yeah, it was wrong if he said it was right.
And that's at the 12b-6 stage. And, yeah. And my understanding of that is he is saying, I'm not going to let you go forward to your proof, because under no circumstances can there be veil piercing under the Fair Housing Act, which is just wrong.
Well, this was at the summary judgment stage?
No, sir. On page 32, which is the district court's order, page 32 of the joint appendix, which is the district court's order.
32 of the joint appendix.
Yes, Your Honor. It actually starts as an opinion on page 25 of the joint appendix. This is the district court's order granting, in part, the 12b-6 motion. He doesn't allow, going forward at the 12b-6 stage, the claim based on ownership. He allows going forward the claim based on corporate broker. And he specifically refers to a case, this is the 12b-6 decision, that talks about veil piercing. Page 32 of the joint appendix and the footnote. Now, our point is that that's enough for notice pleading. The defendants understood what was going on. The judge understood what was going on. We were prepared, certainly at the summary judgment stage, Justice Scalia, we would have been happy to go forward with proof of underfunding, and there is substantial proof of underfunding. We would have been happy to go forward with proof of lack of corporate formalities. This is a company.
Had you alleged any of these things? I mean, opposing counsel referred in his argument to an allegation that the individual taxpayer ID number was being used. Did you allege that in the complaint somewhere?
That we did allege.
Okay, where is it? I mean, this is what we're fishing for. Did you allege anything beyond the mere claim of sole ownership?
Page 7 of the joint appendix, Your Honor. Paragraph 13 toward the bottom of the page. After it's been alleged, the triad was owned by Mr. Meyer.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Got it?
Did you allege anything else? I mean, we've got sole ownership, we've got taxpayer ID. Did you allege anything else that might be a basis for piercing the veil?
We did not allege the details of that. That is to say, we did not allege underfunding, and we did not allege lack of corporate formalities. But it seems to me that's not required under Conley versus Gibson. There is notice pleading, and then we are put to our proof if that had been permitted to go forward to the summary judgment stage.
The point you're making is that you are not certainly required under the federal rules to send out any theory of the pleadings. You just have to state facts showing that there's a claim for relief.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. And it seems to me, in a case decided by this court in the mid-90s, I believe it was Peacock, the court said veil piercing is really not a new claim. It is a theory of relief. We have claimed Fair Housing Act liability in the complaint based on these.
Sorry. Can I ask you this question? We really didn't grant certiorari to decide a California question as esoteric as this one is. And I'm just wondering, do you defend the rationale of the Ninth Circuit, and do you defend the abandon reliance on any federal defense here?
Our position,
our federal,
is that the Ninth Circuit's judgment was correct, but it went too far when it reached out and said, under the Fair Housing Act, we have to go beyond traditional principles of agency. We think the standard should be, just as it is under Title VII, the employment discrimination law, in Kolstad, Burlington Industries, and Farragher, that the standard for vicarious liability under the federal statute should be a federal standard. Mm-hmm. And that standard should be traditional agency principles as informed by the policies of the Fair Housing Act. Now, the Ninth Circuit apparently felt that they had to go beyond traditional agency principles. What we've tried to do in the brief in Roman numerals 1, 2, and 3 is point out three separate and independent alternative theories under traditional agency principles. And in that sense, we think the Ninth Circuit just reached out and tried to do something that wasn't necessary.
Well, then, is your piercing of corporate veil theory a federal theory or a state law theory?
Our position on that is that it's probably federal law, but as I read Best Foods, the court hasn't specifically determined, and if I may say that this is something that I don't have a position on. But either way, we are entitled to a remand, whether it's federal or California law. But the cause of action clearly is the Fair Housing Act. I believe the government takes the position, and we certainly don't disagree with the government, that it is a federal question. And if I may, I want to get into those parts 1, 2, and 3 of our brief, and particularly the first part in vicarious liability. The problem we have with petitioner's argument is that I believe it's based on two faulty assumptions. One is that petitioner wants to take certain parts of the California corporation and real estate law that are advantageous to him, but he doesn't want to take the other part, which is the responsibility part. It is literally true that in California, a corporation can be a broker, but it cannot be a broker unless there is an individual appointed who is an officer of the corporation and has qualified under the broker requirements, and that individual is required by California law to take responsibility for the supervision and control of the agency.
Yes, but your opponent says that the results under California law is he can be disciplined if he fails to do so, but there are no California cases holding him personally liable if he fails to do so.
Our position is that that may be right, it may be wrong. We believe this is a federal standard.
Do you think it's right or wrong?
If we got a remand, Your Honor, we would very much like the opportunity on this basis to argue that it's wrong. There is a California case in 1978 that holds that. But a year later, California amends its licensing statute to add the very key provision in this case, which is 101.59.2, which says that the individual who's appointed by the corporation as the officer broker has personal responsibility. So our argument would be on remand that changed. But I want to make the point
Can I go back to an earlier point you made? You said the California law says that the corporate broker, the one who's designated for the corporation, has to exercise control over the brokers in the corporation. that may well be true. The issue is not whether he has to exercise control. It's whether he exercises control in his personal status, or rather exercises control as an officer of the corporation. If it's in the latter capacity that he exercises control, he should not have a personal liability. It's the corporation that has liability. Now, well, as I understand the California law, this broker could not operate under that license on his own. The only way he could use that license was as an officer of the corporation. Isn't that correct?
I would put it actually a little differently. If you divide the corporation from Mr. Meyer, Mr. Meyer can then apply, because he's qualified, to become a broker. Currently, he would have to file a paper, but he would clearly get the status. But Triad Inc. would cease at that moment being able to be a broker. And none of the acts in this case, none of the salesman acts, could have been performed under the rubric of Triad. And the other point that I was going to make about the petitioner's argument that I think is faulty is it's the assumption that if Triad Inc. is the principal of these agents, nobody else can be the principal of these agents. And that's clearly inconsistent with longstanding agency principles as reflected in the restatement, Section 20, Comment F, which says there can be joint principals.
Oh, yeah. Sure, of course there can, but it's corporation law that the officers of the corporation are not one of those other principals.
Ordinarily, Your Honor, but not in this case. I repeat, this company cannot be a broker if it doesn't have a broker-qualified individual who takes responsibility for the agents.
And do you think the Gibson case that you cited in your brief is on all fours with your case?
No, Your Honor, it's not on all fours. I believe what it says is if the broker is operating as a sole proprietorship, as an individual, he clearly is vicariously liable. That is, by the way, what 86% of the brokers in California do. They operate as sole proprietors, and they are clearly vicariously liable. There is an additional question. What happens when you incorporate? And so it's not exactly on all fours, and I think the jury is out, or the judges are out, with respect to what California would do with that. Some states say, in addition to the corporation, the individual is vicariously liable.
Well, you can't have a corporation. If you want to run a real estate corporation, you can't do it because there has to be a broker's license and you're going to be personally liable. What's the use of having a corporation then?
There are many uses, Your Honor, and I would like to address that. The only thing that we are arguing that Mr. Meyer was responsible for is what I would call the licensed activities. For example, if a broker went out on the way to a meeting and negligently drove his car and caused an accident, that is not the kind of behavior that's subject to broker supervision. And that would be no liability.
But if he defrauds a client, or, I mean, anything that's going to involve big money on the part of the corporation is going to come back on the head of the individual broker. So you're saying if you want to be in the brokerage business, you cannot do it as a practical matter in the corporate form.
Well, I'm not saying
that's,
it, Your Honor.
Well, no, that's what you say that California law says.
Yes, and every state, I want to make this point, every single state says this. 11 states say you can't even operate as a broker as a corporate form. 39 states, including California, said we will allow you to do this, but there has to be one human being that is responsible. And in this particular case, there came a point when Mr. Meyer was trying to get the Triad license extended. California said, you haven't satisfied that because you personally, Meyer, haven't engaged in the continuing education requirements that an officer broker is required.
It's even tougher than what most states provide for lawyers.
It's very analogous to lawyers.
No, it isn't analogous at all. Lawyers can avoid personal liability.
California doesn't give personal liability there, does it? I mean, my statute here says there's an officer who's designated by a corporate broker license, and that officer is responsible for supervision and control of activities conducted on behalf of the corporation. So that suggests that he's conducting that supervision on behalf of the corporation, and so it's the corporation that would respond under the principle of respondeat superior. Evidently, that's what California has held, and given the wording, it seems reasonable.
Well, it held that, and then California's legislature came along and added the requirements. But let me make this observation. When Mr. Crank, the salesperson in this case, wanted to extend his salesperson's license, he was required to have his broker authorize the forms. This was done four times by Mr. Meyer. If you look at the form, Joint Appendix Lodging 75 is the most recent example, but there are three other examples. The California form says, list the company, Triad, and then requires the officer broker, Meyer in this case, to sign a certification which specifically says, I certify this salesperson is employed by me.
I only have 74 pages in my joint appendix. You said it was joint
appendix? I'm sorry. I misspoke. Joint Appendix Lodging, Your Honor.
Oh, okay.
It's the large tan one. And this was done, by the way, for Mr. Crank on four different occasions. What I'm trying to say is this is a classic case of joint principle. That isn't true, Justice Scalia, in every corporate situation. Of course not. We don't argue that. We argue that this is a responsible human being and that that makes him liable.
On the major question that we took the case to decide, what's the general rule? Well, we can ask the government the general rule for when we look to state law and when we look to federal law. Certainly state law informs what the federal law ought to be. That's Farragher and Burlington.
That would be my response as well. We have a federal standard informed by state law. Thank you.
Mr. Stewart.
Thank you, Justice Stevens, and may it please the Court. As this case has been briefed in this Court, it's common ground among the parties and the United States that questions of vicarious liability under the Fair Housing Act are to be decided on the basis of generally applicable principles of agency and corporate law rather than by reference to a rule that's distinct to the FHA. And obviously, it is an important general principle of corporate law.
Do we look to general federal common law agency principles, or are we bound by state agency law?
I think the task for the Court would to be to devise a uniform nationwide rule. That's what the Court said. But certainly, the Court will look, as in Farragher and in Ellerth, the Court looked to the restatement of agency, which for the most part is a compilation of decisions rendered by state courts. So it's looking to the law of the states generally, but it's not looking to the law of a particular state. So with respect to our veil-piercing argument, we would say that the Court should devise a uniform federal.
Well, do you think it's fair to read the complaint that was filed as putting anyone on notice that it was a veil-piercing?
We think that the claim was adequately raised in the district court.
Read it to us?
The plaintiffs.
Because it's not clear to me.
The plaintiffs.
I don't think if I read that complaint, I would read it as one that was proceeding on a veil-piercing theory.
Well,
I would have thought it was proceeding on the designated broker.
Well, the plaintiffs didn't use the phrase veil-piercing, but on page 4 of the joint appendix, for instance, they alleged that Mr. Meyer is the designated officer broker of Triad, the president of Triad. They also alleged that Mr. Meyer was the sole shareholder of Triad. In addition, as Mr. Schwimm pointed out,
that would be consistent with a corporation that's wholly adequately funded whose veil cannot be pierced.
And it's true that they didn't allege in the complaint inadequate capitalization. However, as Mr. Schwimm pointed out, there was a colloquy in the district court in which the petitioner's counsel appeared to acknowledge that the corporation was without assets.
But it isn't. I mean, look, the judge is sitting there on a motion to dismiss the complaint, and he reads the complaint. And when he reads the complaint, he looks to claims, and he sees first claim, Fair Housing Act, which doesn't have a word about this theory. And apparently in the brief, a different theory was produced, the one that's been produced today, that the reason they're liable is not because we want to pierce the veil, but because it's Mr. Meyer who's really the holder of the license in some sense, and that is sufficient. So not surprisingly, the district court says that. He says any liability against Meyer as an officer of Triad would attach only to Triad, in that plaintiffs have not urged theories that could justify reaching Meyer individually, with one exception. And he then goes and discusses the exception. Well, if I were a district judge, I would have thought I'd done my job at that point, unless somebody came in a petition for rehearing and said, Judge, you missed something, which no one did.
I think you're right that the primary theory that the respondents advocated in the district court was based on Mr. Meyer's...
No, Sowell. Let's try Sowell theory.
Well, this was raised and disputed in the Ninth Circuit. That is...
In the footnote.
Not just in the footnote. In the Ninth Circuit, at page 7 and 8 of the petition appendix, the Ninth Circuit, having turned to the possible liability of Mr. Meyer as the shareholder of Triad, and the Ninth Circuit said Petitioner Meyer disputes that he was sued in that capacity. However, the Ninth Circuit goes on to hold, we disagree, we think that claim was adequately raised in the district court.
Of course, what was raised is we get Meyer because Meyer holds the license. And even though it's held in the name of the corporation, that really doesn't matter.
No, but the Ninth Circuit clearly understood the claim against Meyer as shareholder to be distinct from, or at least in addition to, the claim against Meyer as designated officer broker. That is, what seems to us to make this a paradigmatic case for veil piercing, taking the facts in the light most favorable to the respondent, is the combination of functions that Mr. Meyer played. Now, it's true that the respondent, by and large, and the Ninth Circuit appeared to regard these distinct functions as separate and independent bases for liability. But in our view, it's only a short step to say, even if no one of the roles that Mr. Meyer played would be an independently sufficient ground for imposing personal liability, the combination of functions together with the apparent inadequate capitalization.
Mr. Stewart, as I understand the theory of why the failure to bring forward affidavits or some evidentiary proof of these matters at the summary judgment stage was not necessary, as I understand it, the plaintiff's theory is it wasn't necessary because the piercing the veil portion of the complaint never made it to the summary judgment stage. It had been dismissed on the face of the complaint.
Is that correct?
Now, was there an appeal of that dismissal on the face of the complaint?
The ultimate appeal, there was not a separate appeal, but the ultimate appeal that went to the Ninth Circuit was an appeal both from the dismissal of certain portions of the complaint and from the grant of summary judgment.
What portion was it? Was it an appeal of the portion of the complaint that dismissed a veil piercing?
It was not specific. The appeal from the dismissal was with regard to Mr. Meyer's potential liability as shareholder, and the appeal from the grant of summary judgment with regard to his potential liability as designated officer broker was based on the grant of
summary judgment. Addition to the complaint being very vague, the appeal of the dismissal was pretty vague too. I don't understand what if you were objecting to the dismissal of the of a veil-piercing theory, you should have, it seems to me, come forward and say, I object to the dismissal of that theory.
I would acknowledge that the theory that we and the respondents have the veil-piercing theory that we have advanced in this court is a refinement of what was said in the Ninth Circuit, but it's always been part of the case that Mr. Meyer's liability was alleged on the basis not of his status as shareholder, his status as designated officer broker, his status as president. And again, the claim in the Ninth Circuit tended to be more that these were independent bases for liability. And our view is that no one of them would be sufficient in and of itself. Taken together, they established that Mr. Meyer exercised pervasive control.
Stewart, I'm confused about one procedural point. Was there not a final judgment in the district court? End of the rope, one final judgment that says that defendant wins, and then you, from that final judgment, you can take up all rulings against the verdict, the judgment loser?
That's correct. The district judge first threw out on 12b-6 everything except the claim against Mr. Meyer as designated officer broker, and subsequently entered summary judgment for the petitioner on that claim. And then there was a final judgment, and that was taken up to the Ninth Circuit.
And the final judgment would include all the rulings on the way to that final judgment disposing of the entire case.
That's correct. Now, in the course of doing discovery on the designated officer broker question, the plaintiffs unearthed some facts that are potentially relevant to the veil-piercing theory, but they've had no discovery on veil-piercing as such. And another important criterion in determining whether veil-piercing is appropriate is whether the individual bears some degree of personal fault for the wrong alleged. And here, the plaintiff's allegation is that Mr. Meyer negligently supervised Mr. Crank, that was a contributing factor in Crank's ultimate misconduct, and that would suffice to show that aspect of the veil-piercing analysis. I think it's also important to note that courts are typically more willing to pierce the veil in tort cases than in contract cases. This court has described the Fair Housing Act as essentially defining a new type of tort. The theory is that in contract cases, an individual who contracts with a corporation has his own opportunity to assess the corporation's finances and decline to do business if the corporation seems likely not to be able to satisfy its obligations, whereas in a tort case, the potential plaintiff has no opportunity to do that. Inadequate capitalization has always been an important factor in veil-piercing analysis, and really it goes to the question whether the incorporators have adequately respected the independent status of the corporate entity.
You don't rely in your submission on the proposition that under California law the broker is liable?
We don't.
And is that because you accept the distinction between a corporate broker, a broker's license, which is in the corporation?
I think it's partly that. I think it's partly just the general background rule is individual supervisors are ordinarily not vicariously liable for torts committed by the people they supervise.
Suppose in a majority of the states the broker is liable for this, forget the intervening corporate. Suppose in a majority of states the broker is liable for the acts of the salesperson.
May I interrupt? If a consensus developed among the states that designated officers, brokers, were sufficiently different from ordinary supervisors that they should be held vicariously liable, then we would advocate that as the general federal rule, but the respondent has not established that there is such a consensus.
Thank you, Mr. Stewart. Mr. Benedine, you have 7 minutes left.
Your Honors, I would submit at this point, unless there are any further questions.
Yes, Thank you. Excuse me.
I do have. I'm still. What is your response to the assertion that it was not necessary for the plaintiffs to bring forward any affidavits or evidence at the summary judgment stage, because on the veil piercing issue, because that issue was no longer alive at the summary judgment stage? It had been dismissed on the complaint.
Well, I would start from the premise that the veil-piercing theory was never born, not that it wasn't alive. Okay.
In other words, you concede that then, and you fall back on the simple fact that the veil-piercing theory was never
was never really contained in the complaint.
Never contained in the complaint, never raised.
It is actually. I mean, it says that the defendant violated the Fair Housing Act when his agent discriminated. That's what it says in paragraph 41. And then previously in paragraph 13, it lists a whole lot of facts about the relationship of Mr. Meyer to the company, including the fact about the tax numbers and so forth. And so what they say is, you know, the complaint doesn't have to spell out every theory, but it does state some facts there from which this basis could be fairly inferred, and therefore it shouldn't have been dismissed. Rather, they should have had at least an opportunity to argue it. I take it something like that is their claim.
Right. Again, we have to look at what are the allegations in the complaint.
Well, the allegations are just what I said. Paragraph. Yeah.
There are allegations of sole ownership, corporate, that he was the sole owner, that he was the officer broker, and that he was the president, and that the taxes were paid under his ID number, an allegation that's never been proven. I think most telling to what was the issue in this case is the holding of the Ninth Circuit itself. And that's at page 67 of the Joint Appendix, where the Court of Appeals states, where common ownership and management exists, corporate formalities must not be rigidly adhered to, a holding which is clearly erroneous, but which sets out what was the issue in this case. The issue was not undercapitalization. The issue was not mismanagement of corporate formalities. The issue was could Mr. Meyer, as an individual, be held liable because he was the sole owner, president, and designated broker of Triad Realty, excuse me. And for that reason, the Ninth Circuit should be reversed and the judgment of the district court in favor of Mr. Meyer reinstated in full.
Thank you, Mr. Benedon. The case is submitted.